Stephen's Law in the Socratic Form of Evangelism. The method of evangelism which you have learned in this course is based on the principles of these two men. One of these men lived almost close to five centuries before Christ, while the other is a 20th century Christian. Yet the principles of these two men combined produce a very effective tool for evangelism. In this lesson, we're going to examine the principles of these two men, Carl Stevens and Socrates, and try and understand why they are effective. Stevens' Law. Several years ago in Texas, there lived an outstanding Christian layman by the name of Carl Stevens who conducted seminars all over the country for some of our top sales executives in various countries. And his seminar was a one-day affair that cost some $250. And in the seminar, Carl taught people his law, the basis for the law, and then how to apply that law to their particular situation. When I struck up a friendship with him some years ago, he helped me to understand his law. And as I thought about it, I felt like that the place I should apply it was in this area of evangelism. Now, the basis for Stephen's Law is some research that was done by some industrial psychologists on how people make decisions. And, of course, industry wants to know this so that they can fit their advertising effectively to potential buyers. Some years ago, a book was written called Hidden Persuaders, and Vance Packard explored in depth the advertisement business and how consumers respond to the various advertising stimuli. The findings of these psychologists showed that in general, people make decisions on the basis of their five senses. And the sense that is most important in that whole decision-making process is the sense that we call sight. And they said that 87% of the decision-making process is based upon sight. 7% is based upon sound, 3% is based upon touch, and 2% on taste, and 1% on smell. Now, if we take that and try and illustrate it, suppose you go to the store and you want to buy a can of peas. And you look there on the shelf, and one can costs 48 cents, another one costs 52, another one costs 60, another brand is 65, and the very top of the line costs 70 cents a can. How do you go about deciding which of those cans of peas that you're going to buy? Now, if you're rich, you may decide, well, there's nothing but the best for us, and you buy the most expensive. And if you're terribly, terribly poor, you may come along and decide, well, whatever's the cheapest, that's what we're going to have to buy. But if you're middle class, you think, well, we don't necessarily need the very best, but we certainly are not going to buy the poorest, and somehow we decide they're in the middle. But even in the middle, how are we going to decide which of those cans of peas we're going to buy, since it's not in a glass can or a bottle so that we can see what they look like? We can't taste them, we can't smell them or anything else. How will we decide? And of course, if we have seen something advertised, we may decide to try it on that basis. Or there may be a particular brand that we're familiar with, and this is good, therefore, you know, we decide, well, this must be good. And we may decide on that basis. But suppose we know absolutely nothing about the product other than I need this. How will I make that decision? And what do you have to rely on? Just what I see. And the industrial psychologist and manufacturer spend a great deal of money in the designing of that label so that when that hand reaches out, somehow it's drawn to their product rather than to their competitors. But 87% of that decision-making process is based upon sight. Now, what's the application to that? If this is the way that God has wired people together, then as Christians, we should take those principles, knowing them, and to apply them. And in evangelism, that is exactly what we have done. Because every time we are involved in evangelism, we are drawing out the bridge. Because 87% of that decision-making process is going to be based upon what that person sees. And whenever you don't have anything visual going for you, then you are not influencing that decision-making process in the way that you ought to be influencing it. And then if we come and add to it the next, which is the audible aspect, what they hear, then that 7%, and that means that we are now affecting 94% of that decision-making process. And if we take a bath and smell good, why, you know, we may influence it a little more and have our hair, you know, combed. But through sight and what they hear, 94%. And this is why Stephen's Law says this: never tell people what you can show them, and never tell people what you can ask them. Now you can see that the first part of the law deals with the visual part of the presentation, while the second part deals with the audio or the dialogue we are trying to create with the people that we're talking to. So never tell them what you can show them. We've already dealt with the importance of the visual. And now we want to look at the second part. Never tell them what you can ask them. Now it's interesting that when God deals with us, He always wants to carry on a two-way conversation. As I pray, God allows me to speak to Him, and God day after day continues to speak to me through the medium of His Word, and we set up this dialogue. You remember when He was dealing with Isaiah, He said, "Come now and let us reason together, saith the Lord. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool." Because human beings were made by God for dialogue, we have a built-in resistance of being preached at or being preached to. However, if we can enter into a dialogue with people, we're always happy to do that and find it far more interesting. Now, dialogue is not only more enjoyable than a monologue, but it is also more effective in helping the person really understand the gospel. Have you ever gone into a store to buy something? and let's just take the ladies, for instance. You go in and you decide that you want to buy a new sewing machine. And the salesman sits down there at his sewing machine, and he can do the most amazing things in the world with that machine, always explaining to you, do this, do that, and all the rest. And as you listen to that, you know that there's no way in the world that you can keep up with what he's saying. But in the back of your mind, you think, ah, the instruction book is there, and hopefully it'll be clear. And if not, I suppose I could always call back and ask about a particular thing that I don't understand. But have you ever thought to yourself how much better it would be if that guy would get up out of his seat and say, now you just sit down there and begin to tell you to do this and to do that and to help you learn how to do that thing rather than to razzle dazzle you with his ability to do it. Now this is why Stevens' Law says never tell them what you can ask them, because asking includes the other person, but telling them simply cuts them out. And if we apply this part of Stevens' Law to our evangelism, we're going to find that we are greatly helped in the following ways. Because Stevens' Law, first of all, helps us to present the gospel in the most effective way, because there is the visual presentation, which affects 87% of the decision-making process, and then there is the dialogue, reasoning together about these things, which affect another 7%, so that 94% of the decision-making process is hopefully being favorably affected by what they both see and what they hear. Then, the second thing, Stevens' Law, it helps you create a dialogue rather than a monologue. It includes that person into the conversation where we are reasoning together. Then, it helps to maintain their interest, because if you have them engaged in a dialogue, then they stay with you. But if they sense that you're either preaching at them or to them, eventually they will kind of turn you off and turn on their uh-huh, and they don't know what you're saying, and you certainly do not know what they are thinking. And then if we create a dialogue, it also aids us in spotting any particular problems or hang-ups that they have. Because there is always this feedback that is coming to us, which then helps us to be able to shift what we are saying to meet that particular need. And then it helps us to build from the known, what they know and understand, to the unknown. And then it also assists the other person to discover the truth for themselves. Because what you are doing is forcing them to go through that reasoning process rather than just you to go through the reasoning process. But if they turn you off, the only person who's doing any reasoning, it's you. But if you have that dialogue and you are extracting it from them, you are forcing them to reason premise by premise and to draw certain conclusions about the verses that you are looking at, and they are discovering for themselves. How often have you been somewhere and have heard something that you think, man, that's terrific? And then you get home and try and tell somebody about this terrific thing, and all at once it just won't come together. Because you heard it and it went in one ear and it goes out the other ear, and somehow what should have happened in between didn't happen because that particular teacher was not smart enough to get you to reason that through. But if you would have reasoned it through, then it would be a very small thing for you to be able to recreate what you had already discovered for yourself. But if he's discovered it and you think, oh boy, that's really great, I want to remember that, but there's no way in the world that you're going to remember it unless somehow you have reasoned that thing out for yourself. To help us further in creating a meaningful dialogue with the person, we want to examine the principles of another man by the name of Socrates, and as we combine this man's skill with Stevens' law, we find an exciting new dimension in effective witnessing. Socrates was one of the great philosophers of all times. He lived from 469 BC to 399 in ancient Greece, and his basic philosophy was that goodness is based on wisdom, and that wickedness, therefore, is a result of ignorance. He believed that no man would willfully choose evil, but that in ignorance one might choose an evil that appeared to be good at the moment. Now, his philosophy that men would not willfully choose something that is wrong, as Christians, we simply would reject that, because we know that man does willfully choose wrong over right. And we disagree with his philosophy, but his method and ability to be able to teach people, we do not want to reject. Now, Socrates loved Athens and spent his days stimulating the people to intelligent thinking by asking probing questions about their opinions. And then when they would answer, he would ask further questions based on their answer in an effort to help them to develop logical and well-thought-out convictions rather than to have empty opinions. Through this process, Socrates hoped to help people to discover true knowledge and wisdom. In the course of events, Socrates offended some of the leading elders of the city as he began to point out their hollow, empty opinions. And eventually they brought a charge against him of corrupting the youth of Athens, because the young people, who were not threatened by Socrates, loved to reason with him. And as a result of that reasoning process, he often, pointed out the fallacy of some of the things that were being done. And so they brought this charge, and at the age of 70, he was put to death by drinking the poison hemlock. But again, this whole process of deductive reasoning through dialogue was the thing that he brought to the world and has got to be one of the most effective teaching methods known to mankind. And perhaps one of the greatest or the best and easiest examples is a story or a dialogue called Credo. And if you go to the library and ask for the dialogues of Plato rather than Socrates, because Plato was his disciple and after his death recreated these dialogues. But the easiest one perhaps to read and the most delightful is one called Credo, because in the day that Socrates was put to death, he and some of Socrates' other friends had bribed the guards, and they were going to go in and spirit Socrates away and save his life. But when they bring this plan to Socrates, he says, "Now, wait a minute, Credo." He said, "I want to ask you a question." And he begins this deductive reasoning process, so that at the end of the day, he has brought Crito to the place where he says, Socrates, you have got to drink the poison hemlock, because if you do not, you will deny everything for which you have ever stood. And it is absolutely delightful to see the way that he starts out taking Crito from here and bringing him to the place that you must die, which Socrates already knew. But rather than to tell him, for him to discover that for himself, and premise by premise, he draws him in and begins to reason with him. So Socrates' form of reasoning was deductive, which means that you go from the known to the unknown, and from the general to the specific. The basic ingredients in this form of reasoning is what we talked about last week. It is a syllogism. It is based upon having a major premise and a minor premise, and from those two premises we draw a conclusion. Our major premise could be that all men are handsome. Perry is a man. Conclusion? That Perry is handsome. Now, some of you may decide to disagree with the major premise that all men are handsome. And if your major premise or your minor premise is wrong, then whatever conclusion you draw will also be wrong. And so in this whole reasoning process, the major premise and the minor premise must be correct. And then from that, we begin to deduct and to draw a conclusion. And then the other strength of Socrates is that when he dealt with other people, he extracted from them premise by premise and forced that person to reason for themselves and to draw the conclusions necessary to establish his next major premise, to which he would then add a minor premise. So how does this apply, and what is Socratic evangelism? And Socratic evangelism employs the Socratic method of dialogue and deductive questioning in an effort to help people to discover the truth about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. It helps them to discover for themselves the truth that I wanted to tell them. And premise by premise, I have got to extract the fact of sin, the penalty of sin, that there is judgment, and so on and so forth, as we reason our way through the gospel. Now, it's interesting, as we go to the scriptures, that we in fact find this very sort of dialogue taking place with Jesus when he reasons with the woman at the well. And this is found for us over in John chapter 4, verses 7 through 20, and I'm going to read that for us. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water, and Jesus said unto her, Give me to drink, for his disciples were gone away into the city to buy meat. Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, How is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. And Jesus answered and said unto her, If thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that saith to thee, Give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked of him, and he would have given thee living water. And the woman said unto him, Sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence then hast thou that living water? Art thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us the well, and drank thereof himself, and his children, and his cattle? And Jesus answered and said unto her, Whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again. But whosoever shall drink of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. And the woman said to him, Sir, give me this water, that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw. And Jesus said unto her, Go, and call thy husband, and come hither. And the woman answered and said, I have no husband. And Jesus said unto her, Thou hast well said, I have no husband, for thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. In that sayest thou truly. And the woman said unto him, Sir, I perceive thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is a place where men ought to worship. And Jesus said unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, that the true worshipper shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. And the woman said unto him, I know that Messiah cometh, which is called Christ. For when he is come, he will tell us all things. And Jesus said unto her, I that speaketh unto thee am he. Notice how in 20 short verses, Jesus had drawn her from a simple everyday conversation into a deep dialogue about eternal things and about her deepest personal needs. He didn't preach at her. He talked with her, leading her gently to the truth that he wanted her to discover. Now, it's interesting, as you look at this little dialogue that takes place between the two of them, because when that woman began to get under pressure, when he put his finger on her moral life, she said, well, you say that you have to worship at Jerusalem. And Jesus said anything about her worshiping in Jerusalem? No. And when he had shot that one down, her next line of defense is, well, we know that when the Messiah comes, he'll teach us all things. And, Jesus said, I that speaketh unto thee am he. But in those 20 short verses, he gently led her from one step to another to another. And this whole process of deductive reasoning we find in the scriptures. Now, the advantage to the Socratic form is, first of all, it uses deductive reasoning. Secondly, it creates a dialogue. Third, it helps you see the other person's problem or point of need. It builds the gospel on biblical principles. And then it personalizes the gospel for everyone that you present it to, because we are reasoning together. We are writing on that piece of paper what we have extracted from them, their conclusions and not our conclusions. And if those are their conclusions, then they will not end up rejecting them at the very end. And the Spirit of God will use that to draw those people to a saving knowledge in Jesus Christ. Stephen's law, never tell them what you can show them. Because 87% of that decision-making process, whether you are selling a tangible or an intangible object, is based upon what people see. And then the second part of that, never tell them what you can ask them, goes back to this Socratic deductive form of reasoning, of building from what people already know and accept and leading them from the known to the unknown. And if you learn to employ that in your evangelism, I promise you that the Spirit of God will use that. Now, the question may come in your mind, are we therefore then trying to manipulate people? Are we, after all, not supposed to be trusting the Spirit of God? And I don't think that we're manipulating people at all. If this is the way that God has wired us together, and we know and understand that, then we certainly ought to capitalize on it. And again, our job is simply to proclaim the truth. And we are not manipulating people when we present the truth in the most effective manner and methods known to us. We must trust the Spirit of God when we have done our job to the very best of our ability, then for Him to do His job.